Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated September 28th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. On the front page, Syngenta draws plans for new expansion by Amanda Jones Hoyle from the Research Triangle Park. Already having established a strong foothold here, Switzerland-based Syngenta has another multi-million-dollar expansion of its Research Triangle Park campus on the drawing boards. The global agribusiness company has submitted revisions to its site plan at 9 Davis Drive to include a Phase 2, which would involve construction of a nearly 200,000-square-foot building with administrative office space and research laboratory. That would be enough space to accommodate about 360 workers, according to the plan submitted to Durham County planners in mid-September. Syngenta's biotechnology division, which has its headquarters in RTP, currently employs 400 people here. The Phase 2 complex would be built adjacent to a $71 million greenhouse and research building that is under construction and scheduled to open later this year. While the plans are there, Syngenta's timetable for fulfilling them has not been firmed up. Spokesman Stephen Goldsmith says no decision has been made on whether new construction in RTP will be funded beyond the current work on the high-tech greenhouse. We are merely ensuing that we could accommodate future growth if the company decides to invest here, he says when questioned about the new site plans. Last year, when Syngenta executives were trying to decide where they were going to invest funds for a new greenhouse and research facility, Durham was competing against sites in China, Singapore, and Brazil. Durham County's Board of Commissioners promised the company $225,000 in incentives if it chose the RTP site in Durham County, even though the greenhouse is expected to create only about 15 additional jobs. Company officials at that time told county officials that incentives from the local government would be a key consideration in its final decision, particularly considering that costs in overseas markets were lower than that expansion cost in Durham, according to minutes from county commissioner meetings. The company's planning department staff also gave the greenhouse project expedited priority status to push it through the approvals process quicker than typical projects. The Phase 2 plans have so far not been elevated to priority status, says Danny Coltra with the Durham City County Planning Department. Ted Connor, Vice President of Economic Development for the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce, says Syngenta is trying to make sure it will be ready to go when and if it decides to expand again in RTP. The site plan process is a laborious process, and it can take some time, Connor says. But it's still just a plan that has not been approved, he says. Believe me, I wish it had. Connor did not indicate whether Syngenta was seeking more local or state incentives for the Phase 2 expansion project in RTP. Syngenta Biotechnology has had a presence in RTP since 1984 and conducts most of its research related to plant gene technology in North America from its 200,000-square-foot facility off East Cornwallis Road. The agribusiness giant also has a crop science division office in Greensboro. Syngenta last year generated more than $13 billion in sales of seeds and protection products and posted double-digit percentage gains in revenue and net income. It has grown to become the third largest purveyor of seeds in the world behind Monsanto and DuPont, as well as a leader in the production of insecticides and herbicides. Syngenta employs more than 26,000 people in 90 countries and continues to expand globally. On September 21st, it announced plans to build an $85 million hybrid seed and crop protection production facility in Russia. Construction continues on a $100 million biotechnology research and development center in Beijing, China. Syngenta's biotechnology division in RTP moved most of its administrative staff into a 95,000-square-foot building in Keystone Technology Park in Durham in early 2010, freeing up more space for research in RTP. But the Keystone office move was never intended to be a permanent solution. Bill Havlak, head of site operations for Syngenta Biotechnology, said at the time that it would provide flexibility until the campus was fully developed. Syngenta's lease term at Keystone Park runs through 2015. A new administration and research building on Davis Drive would allow Syngenta Biotechnology to bring its employees at Keystone Park back to its campus. Next up, Rogers, North Carolina's metros must work together. By Chris Bagley from Raleigh. North Carolina's metro areas will have to cooperate extensively as economic competition becomes more global, Duke Energy Corporation Chairman and CEO Jim Rogers told about 250 business and community leaders on September 27th at his first public appearance in the Triangle since the merger with Progress Energy was completed. That means new partnerships between traditional utilities and alternative energy companies and a beefed-up focus on economic development, Rogers said. He also pointed to cost savings that Charlotte-based Duke had promised as it continues to integrate with Progress after the company's July 2nd merger and to enrich talent pool at the combined company. The breakfast gathering was the first here in which he took questions from the public. The Progress merger was the third and largest that Rogers has orchestrated as a utility chief, but it created unease among former Progress employees and some Triangle business leaders after Duke's board unexpectedly kept Rogers in place and sacked incoming CEO Bill Johnson, the former Progress CEO. "I really have a laser focus on integrating these two companies," Rogers said. "My experience in talking to employees across the system is that they want to move forward. Our people have clarity about what we're doing." Rogers said he understands the perspective of employees at a smaller merger partner, noting that he helped orchestrate the earlier two mergers as CEO of the smaller companies, the one that created Synergy in 1994, and then Synergy's merger with Duke in 2006. One attendee asked about a perceived Charlotte-Raleigh rivalry and asked Rogers when the cities will drop it. "We need to put this Raleigh-Charlotte thing behind us and focus on the future," Rogers said. "In every county in the state, we're going to be focused on trying to do business development." The combined company has retail customers in more than 80 of North Carolina's 100 counties. Some of the expected $700 million in savings will come from consolidating a workforce that numbered about 29,000 on the merger date. Large chunks will also come from joint operation of the utilities generating fleets in the Carolinas and from increased buying power in the markets for coal, natural gas, and nuclear fuel. Rogers parried questions about the extent of the rate increases that Duke and its Progress Energy Carolina subsidiary expect to seek later this year. Progress could ask regulators for an increase as soon as October 5. Duke's request is likely to come in late November or December, spokesman Mike Hughes says. Electricity rates in the state are competitive, but power still represents a significant and critical expense for many of the utility's industrial customers in North Carolina, said Raleigh attorney Ralph McDonald, who represents a group of such customers in a separate interview on Wednesday. McDonald's group and another have already applied as formal participants in the Progress rate case. Duke executive Brett Carter, who moved to Raleigh to take over as president of the company's North Carolina operations, says the merger makes economic development more effective and more efficient, particularly when company representatives travel out of state to recruit new customers. Carter says Duke is in the process of updating its database with available commercial properties in eastern North Carolina. In response to an audience member who asked how long North Carolina would keep its system of regulated utilities, Rogers gave a vigorous defense of the model. "Deregulation has rarely led to lower electricity rates, and it doesn't usually do enough to encourage investment in multi-billion dollar power plants that will generate power for decades," he says. He also argued, as he often argued, that the combined company must and can invest in lower emission plants. "While expensive, some of the company's newest gas-fired plants are more efficient than the coal-fired plants they're replacing," Rogers says. Duke is pursuing an all-of-the-above strategy, including gas, nuclear power, alternative energy, and efficiency programs. Rogers also briefly touched on his role in the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte in early September, where he addressed energy policy. It's a subject that hasn't drawn nearly enough attention in the presidential campaign season, Rogers says. And now for this week's lead article on the front page, Blue Cross versus the docs. Reimbursements at core of dispute between insurer and radiologist, but implications are much wider. By Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. Little known to them, patients visiting a radiologist in North Carolina aren't just getting scans and x-rays. They're also stepping slap dab in the middle of a simmering battle going on behind the scenes between their radiologist and their insurance company. The outcome of this dispute could set a precedent affecting the entire healthcare landscape. At the heart of the fight are contracts that health insurers hash out with providers, in this case radiologists, and what leeway the insurers have in changing the amount they reimburse for various services. On October 25, 2011, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina filed a notice with the North Carolina Department of Insurance that it would reduce the amount it reimburses radiologists. That's because Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina alleges that doctors were double charging to the tune of $16 million a year in unnecessary claims to Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina alone. Radiologists across the state objected to the reduction in reimbursements, and on December 1, 2011, the Department of Insurance blocked the rate decrease, citing a 2009 state law. Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina, based in Chapel Hill, has been joined in the dispute by giant insurer Aetna, based in Hartford, Connecticut. The companies say the 2000 law does not apply in this situation, so they should be allowed to lower their reimbursement rates. Medical groups, including the North Carolina Medical Society, the North Carolina Hospital Association, both in Raleigh, and the North Carolina Radiological Society, based in Charlotte, don't condone any potential double billing, but argue that the law gives providers the ability to object to an insurance provider forcing a payment reduction. At this point, it's not about whether this particular policy is good or bad, said North Carolina Medical Society CEO Robert Seligson in a statement. It's about whether Blue Cross or any commercial health plan can change material contract terms with physicians unilaterally. We don't think that's fair. That's what this is about, basic fairness in the contractual relationship. Now a special hearing officer will decide what the legislature meant when it passed the law. Under the third-party payer system in this country, health insurers negotiate deals with hospitals and doctors to pay a set amount per procedure. Sometimes that agreed-upon amount can differ drastically from the charges a hospital lists. At Duke University Health System in Durham, for example, the hospital listed $6.2 billion of total charges in 2011, but collected only $2.14 billion in revenue. Some two-thirds of that reduction is taken in charity care and losses from Medicare and Medicaid, but negotiations with private insurers play a role in the reduction as well. The 2009 law requires insurers to give 60 days notice of a contract amendment and allows providers to object. At that point, the insurer would have the right to terminate the contract if desired. In the case of the radiologist, the Department of Insurance says the statute applies and wants to force Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina to file for a contract amendment to change how it reimburses radiologists. The health insurer says the statute does not apply, so it should be allowed to change its reimbursement without the option for radiologists to block the change through an objection. The technical point being argued concerns the definition of a fee schedule, a term in the medical community that relates to reimbursement. The insurers argue that fee schedule refers only to the maximum that any insurer would pay for a particular procedure, not what is actually paid. Since the maximum fee for radiology services wouldn't change, this law shouldn't apply, they say. Providers argue that fee schedule applies to a wide range of reimbursements, so the law should apply. The definition of fee schedule is limited, argued Carl Younger, an attorney with Nelson Mullins in Raleigh, representing Aetna, in a hearing on September 21st. The fee schedule simply doesn't change. Todd Hemphill, an attorney with Bodie, Call, and Stroop in Raleigh, who represents providers to the North Carolina Medical Society, argued the opposite. If the fee schedule referred only to the maximum, then providers would have no recourse to object to the reimbursement amount, he said at the hearing. Keith Kapp of Williams Mullen in Raleigh represents Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina. North Carolina Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin appointed Bill Hale, a former Department of Insurance executive with 2 decades of experience, as the hearing officer. He could rule as early as the week beginning October 1. After his ruling, parties would have the option to appeal to the Wake County Superior Court. And now, inside the front cover, better contract tracking, goal of state effort. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. A legislative oversight committee wants better records kept of state contracts worth $1 million or more as they pass through a required review process. Various state agencies on average spend $242 million a month to buy contracted services. Yet, earlier this year, when North Carolina auditor Beth Wood went looking for a comprehensive list of the $1 million plus contracts that had passed through reviewers at the North Carolina Department of Justice, no log was available. She also found that contract reviewers often relied on officials at other state departments to refer documents to them for examination. The state spends billions of dollars on contract services each year, Wood concluded. Without a sufficient system in place, it is impossible to know the value of service contracts properly reviewed or how much in service contracts were not reviewed. Now, 4 months before state lawmakers are due back in Raleigh for the 2013 session, the 18-member Joint Legislative Program Evaluation Oversight Committee is considering ways to close the gaps. In a proposed bill under discussion, the Departments of Administration and Justice would identify all of the $1 million plus contracts signed by other state agencies that are subject to review. The Attorneys General's Office would then be responsible for keeping a master list of what gets examined. The committee is still in the process of reviewing this, says John Turcotte, director of the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division. We are still in the discussion-only stage. Under the current system, when the state contracts of $1 million or more are reviewed, AG staffers look to see that they are in proper legal form, are enforceable, and that, as written, they will accomplish the intended purposes. Auditor's Office spokesman Dennis Patterson says Wood met with the Joint Oversight Committee to go over her office's earlier findings and has been participating in the group's discussions. The proposed remedies, including creation of a master list, he adds, appear to hit the mark. This is what we've been pushing for. The Joint Committee, chaired by Representative Julia Howard, a Moxville real estate appraiser, has until the opening of the 2013 session in January to finalize its recommendations. Turcotte says that in addition to the contract review questions, the committee is looking into the training provided procurement and contract administration officials throughout state agencies with the view of improving how state contracts are written in the first place and of avoiding cost overruns. The aim, in the words of another Joint Oversight Committee member, Senator Daniel Klotfelter of Charlotte, is to give the state a more robust contracting process. Next up, Patients' Data, a Tricky Hurdle in Care Reform, by Chris Bagley, from Dunn. Leaders of a regional hospital say a new system for tracking patients' medical data has a glitch that's likely to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars annually, highlighting a bump in the road for many healthcare providers as they comply with the sweeping reform law that President Obama signed in 2010. The nonprofit Harnett Health System Incorporated, which serves patients in Harnett and Johnston counties, had the new system developed and installed over the course of 2010 and 2011. It was supposed to communicate automatically with its billing system for what's known as acuity-based billing. Rather than charging a fee for each medical service performed, such systems determine the overall complexity of the care a patient receives and then bills on that basis. Harnett Health has sued the contractor, Medical Information Technology, or MedTech, of Westwood, Massachusetts, allegedly that the system failed to handle acuity-based billing at Betsy Johnson Regional Hospital in Dunn. One key shortcoming was that it was prone to underbill patients, according to the lawsuit Harnett Health filed in federal court in Raleigh on September 13th. In-house employees and outside contractors are doing manually what the new system was designed to do automatically, says attorney Charles George of Wyrick Robbins in Raleigh, who is representing the hospital. George estimates the additional cost is well above $100,000 annually. A different vendor is installing and beginning to test software that assesses for acuity, George says. Meditech's system performs most of the functions for which it was designed and hasn't compromised the privacy of any patient's medical records, he adds. It was supposed to be a full-fledged system that was going to do everything, George says. Meditech spokesman Paul Berthang declined to comment on the lawsuit. Hospitals across the nation have been adopting electronic medical records in growing numbers in the last decade, and a pair of federal laws passed in 2009 and 2010 have accelerated the shift dramatically, says Noah Huffstedler, who represents healthcare providers as an attorney in Nelson Mullins' Raleigh office. Acuity-based billing is a crucial feature for many of the systems. The American Recovery and Investment Act, commonly known as the 2009 stimulus, reimburses hospitals for new electronic systems that incorporate the new billing format. Harnett Health contends in its lawsuit that its systems problems have been an obstacle to reimbursement. That is a very common problem, Huffstedler says, while emphasizing that he has no direct knowledge of Harnett Health's lawsuit. A lot of that litigation is going on, and it's tremendously important to hospitals. Glitches are common in part because electronic medical records are relatively uncharted waters, Huffstedler says. Even most industries pumped terabytes of information onto the internet in the 1990s and 2000s. Hospitals and physicians' offices were slow to digitize patients' data for reasons ranging from privacy concerns to the initial cost. An inpatient rehabilitation facility adopting an EMR system can expect to spend $2,000 to $3,000 per bed over the first 5 years, according to a 2011 study that the CIO Consortium performed for the American Healthcare Association, a trade organization for nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Still, Huffstedler and others in the healthcare sector say electronic records have the potential to reduce costs dramatically for patients, hospitals, and insurers, as well as for taxpayers, who ultimately bear significant costs through the Medicare and Medicaid programs. A patient history in digital form can be transferred easily from one healthcare provider to another, reducing the cost associated with redundant tests and diagnoses, and potentially helping a doctor diagnose a condition that he or she might otherwise miss. And now, humans' best friends. Animal meds provide entree to developing human meds. By Lauren K. Alsons. From Raleigh, pharmaceutical company executives are beginning to realize the benefits of veterinary medicine, both as a business model and as an alternative path to developing drugs for humans. Take former Inspire Pharmaceuticals president Greg Mossinghoff and his new Raleigh company, Zoion, which he founded to create a treatment for canine dry eye. While his background is in the development of drugs for humans, Mossinghoff says there are benefits in shifting to animal medicine. It's a lower-risk venture, he says, noting that animal clinical trials take one-tenth the resources and cost of traditional human clinical trials. Fewer resources and less time, he adds, combine to create a quicker payout for investors. Estimates vary, but human discovery and trial costs have been pegged as high as $1.8 billion for a single drug. Durham-based Skynexis CEO Yves Ribel cites another benefit of veterinary applications. Information gleaned in an animal trial can be adopted for a human clinical trial for the same compound. In May, Skynexis partnered with British veterinary company Dechra to push its own dry eye treatment into canine trials while continuing to work on its own human drug for the malady. We knew that one of the ways to validate our technologies and eventually to get some financial reward on the research we have taken in developing that technology was to partner with an animal drug company, Rebel says. The big advantage is the proof of concept, he says, adding that such proof can be achieved more quickly in an animal trial, and that can lead to investor interest in a human trial. It should be relatively quickly validated in animals and can bring in rewards in terms of milestones and warranty, he says, adding that animal trials typically precede human trials anyway, so why not help pets in the process? It's a concept Rebel has not kept to himself. He says he's told his collaborative partners that their drugs, too, might find a place in veterinary medicine. Karen Munana, who conducts veterinary clinical trials at NC State University's College of Veterinary Medicine, particularly in the area of canine epilepsy, says the trials themselves aren't that different, animal to human. In essence, we're trying to answer the same sort of questions, she says, adding that traditionally it's been hard to get financial backing for veterinary trials. A lot of what I have done is to look at a product that has already been approved in the human market and then see if it makes sense to study for animals. It's what she is currently doing with canine epilepsy, studying available human treatments and how they can be utilized in dogs. She's working with an undisclosed big pharma company, one that typically creates drugs for humans. Trial animals are typically recruited much the same way patients are, through a general practitioner, in this case a veterinarian. Owners provide informed consent and veterinarians conduct the trials, which are regulated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and must be approved by the board of the hospital sponsoring the trial. In addition to pharma partners, trials get funding from grants such as California nonprofit Toby's Foundation, a group helping Munano with her trial. Kim Chappell, a clinical assistant professor at the veterinary school, says veterinary medicine trials typically take in a maximum of a few hundred patients, as opposed to thousands in human trials. Trials deal in similar language, phases 1, 2, and 3, and they require a new animal drug application with the FDA. Often due to the shorter lifespan of an animal, trials take significantly less than the 10 years it typically takes to bring a human drug to market. But there is a downside. The mechanisms and machines for doing clinical research in animals is less developed, she says. Continuing on to the inside, more people opting to shop for finance-related services. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. While local bankers have been working hard to pull in new customers, a significant number of households in Raleigh-Cary continue to look elsewhere for check cashing, certain types of consumer loans, and other finance-related services. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation dubs these people the underbanked, and between 2009 and 2011, their local numbers exploded. There were some 39,000 underbanked households in 2009, or 8.9% of the total. In 2011, the figure vaulted to 73,000 households, or nearly 16% of the total. The numbers come from a new FDIC survey that didn't include metro data for Durham and Chapel Hill. The underbanked, as defined by the regulatory agency, are people who may have checking and savings accounts in a bank. Yet, when the need arises, they turn to non-bank sources for money orders, check cashing, payday loans, rent-to-own agreements, tax refund anticipation loans, or they go to pawn shops. It's a lot, says Durham's Peter Skillerin, Executive Director of Reinvestment Partners, a Durham nonprofit that advocates against predatory lending, of the almost 80% increase in households using alternative financing. What's behind it? Higher bank fees, tighter credit standards, hard times, and consumer choice, Skillerin says. From our point of view, people don't have to have all their financial transactions with a bank, he adds. The question is whether the alternatives they are turning to are fair and affordable. One of the hottest such alternatives these days, Skillerin says, is prepaid debit cards. The use of a non-bank financing options comes at a time, ironically, when local bankers have been doing a better job of getting customers through the door. The number of people in Raleigh and Cary included in a consumer subset known as the unbanked, those with neither a checking or savings account, fell from 18,000 in 2009 to 12,000 in 2011, according to FDIC data. Even so, bankers ignore the legion of underbanked at their own risk, says Kathleen Wales, Senior Vice President and Financial Services Expert with Washington, D.C.-based communications firm Levick. Nationally, nearly 20% of households are underbanked, she says. It's a number banks need to pay attention to. Another banking expert, Don Coker, agrees. He says these numbers are going up as evidence that banks are missing out on lots of opportunities to make money. Next up, storms belt insurers in 2011, with Farm Bureau paying $425 million. It is said to be the worst year in history for Raleigh Company, and caused a bottom line loss of $235 million. This article is by Lee Weisbecker, and it's from Raleigh. A hurricane on the coast, tornadoes in the Triangle, and severe thunderstorms in Charlotte made for a gutsy 2011 at Raleigh-based North Carolina Farm Bureau Insurance Company. The pounding hail, flying shingles, and snapping limbs produced an extra 61,000 claims for a total of $425 million in claims at the state's third-largest property and casualty insurer. Reinsurance and investment earnings brought the net loss to $235 million. It was unfamiliar territory for the 59-year-old firm, whose customer base spans the state and whose written premiums total more than $935 million. It was the worst year in the history of the company, says Executive Vice President Steve Carroll. Farm Bureau wasn't the only leading property insurer to feel the effects. State Farm Fire and Casualty, with $443 million in North Carolina premiums, posted a loss of $1.4 billion in 2011. Meanwhile, Nationwide Mutual, with premiums of $486 million, recognized net losses of $910, according to statewide data supplied by the North Carolina Department of Insurance. So far, 2012 has not brought a repetition of events. The storm clouds have parted, putting Farm Bureau, as the company is called, back on solid footing. Strong revenue returns have allowed it to beef up its reserves by an additional $50 million. The company also implementing a plan to reduce its exposure to the hurricane-prone coastal region, moving some customers off its books, says Carroll. One option for them is signing on to the Beach Plan, a pool of coastal underwriters set up by the industry. Despite the 2012 bounce back, some lingering effects of 2011 remain at Farm Bureau, including a decision announced September 20th by Standard & Poor's to cut the company's financial strength rating to BBB from A. In taking the step, the rating agency cited the insurer's 2011 performance and continued exposure to North Carolina weather-rated incidents. The BBB rating still leaves the company in investment-grade territory. Carroll says S&P's unsolicited rating action didn't come as a shock and should have few, if any, immediate consequences. If Farm Bureau was planning to head to the investor market to sell corporate notes or bonds, it would face higher interest rates because of the downgrade. But we have no notes or bonds planned, he says. The company's last note sale came back in 2006. Another financial services rater, AM Best, also aware of the 2011 performance in April, affirmed North Carolina Farm Bureau's A, excellent rating. Prior to 2011, remarks Best analyst Frederick DeLeon, North Carolina Farm Bureau's underwriting performance had been better than the composite average. Opening its doors in 1953, Farm Bureau began by selling auto coverage in the state's rural communities, but over time expanded its product line and reached into the cities. Nowadays, autos make up about 60% of its coverage, with policies on homes and other property representing the rest. It has a North Carolina market share of nearly 14%. The weather culprits that play havoc with the bottom line were two spring 2011 events: a line of tornadoes that touched down in Raleigh, Sanford, and Fayetteville in April, and a thunderstorm complex that pounded Charlotte with hail and high winds in May. It doesn't take a major hurricane, says Mike Newton of the North Carolina Insurance Guarantee Association, yet 2011 brought one of those two, with the arrival of Irene at the coast in August. And now, Shooping Russell takes stake in pharma spun out of UNC. By Lauren K. Alsons, from Raleigh. A drug development company with Triangle roots is making a $2 million bet that it can design a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. Pharmatropics, a spinoff out of UNC Chapel Hill, has raised $800,000 so far in the debt round, according to a securities filing. Previously called Longo Pharmaceutical, the company, which lists a Raleigh address but primarily operates out of San Francisco, aims to treat disorders of the central nervous system, particularly Alzheimer's, a degenerative disease that stands as the sixth leading cause of death in the United States, according to the Alzheimer's Association. The financing represents the first debt offering for the company. Previously, Pharmatropics netted $300,000 in a founder's grant from the Alzheimer's Drug Discovery Foundation, or ADDF, for work that, in 2008, the foundation's executive director, Howard Fillett, said showed great promise and, if successful, will become an entirely new class of drugs for neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Additionally, equity rounds in 2010 and 2008 netted about $500,000. Pharmatropics develops small molecule compounds that mimic the function of a type of protein that's responsible for the development of neurons. The hope is that the molecules will target degeneration caused by protein beta amyloid, the plaque that impairs memory, and is being investigated as a potential cause of Alzheimer's. It's a very important approach, Fillett says. The small molecules are neuroprotective and are molecules that stimulate active pathways that are really fundamental to preventing cell death. Investors include Sally Shooping Russell, managing director of Durham-based BlackRock Alternative Advisors and one of the founding members of Duke Management Company, which oversees the Duke University Endowment. Shooping Russell said she could not comment on the funding due to regulatory restrictions, but did say the company is hoping to do great things. Pharmatropics could be the first success story in an Alzheimer's market marred with recent failures, such as Eli Lilly's drug in August and a Pfizer-Johnson & Johnson joint effort earlier this month. But the company has been doing research for 7 years and still has no trial data. That could be coming soon. Fillett couldn't offer details, but says the company is currently raising money for that trial. Company founder Frank Longo, professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at UNC, before leaving to chair Stanford University's Department of Neurology and Neurological Sciences in 2005, began his research with Steve Massa, a former colleague and professor at the University of California at San Francisco. When asked for comment about the debt filing, Massa said his interest in pharmatropics was purely academic and that he couldn't make any statement on anything regarding pharmatropics. Longo did not respond to interview requests, nor did his wife, company CEO Ann Longo, who serves as the Director of Development of Neurosciences at Stanford University. Pharmatropics' first big setback wasn't in the laboratory. It was in the termination of its first big pharma agreement. Pharmatropics entered into an exclusive global collaboration agreement with Irish drug maker Elan Corporation in 2009, but that licensing agreement was terminated in 2010, with Elan recording an impairment charge of $5 million. Elan's 2011 annual report shows that the charge was offset by a credit of $3 million, a deferred payment under the initial agreement. That report also lists a pharmatropics property, plant, and equipment asset impairment charge of $11 million related to a consolidation of facilities in South San Francisco when Elan realigned its bioneurology business. One person not dissuaded by setbacks in UNC's Office of Technology Development's Assistant Director Henry Nowak, who reaffirmed that pharmatropics is one to watch. They could do it, he says. Next up, local Lenovo exec pledges company will become number one. By Lauren K. Ansons from Morrisville. Lenovo will overtake HP as the number one PC maker in terms of sales within 6 months, and the Chinese company with U.S. headquarters in Morrisville will hit $5 billion in sales by the end of its fiscal year in March. Those are the predictions of Jay Parker, Vice President and General Manager of Lenovo North America, who is based in Morrisville. We know what our goals are and what our trajectory is, Parker told attendees at Triangle Business Journal's Global Research Triangle Conference on September 20th. The company projects growth, always at about 20 points faster than the market, he says. In its 2012 fiscal year ending in March, the company's total revenue was up by 37% to nearly $30 billion over the previous year. Lenovo's worldwide share of the PC market stands at about 15%, noted company CEO Yang Yuqing during an August earnings call with investors. Just a year ago, we were behind the number one PC maker, HP, by just 6 points, but now we have narrowed the gap to just 0.7 of a point, the CEO says. The challenge for the company is to capture more of the North American market, where Lenovo's market share is just 8.5%. To that end, the company is focusing in the small to medium business and consumer market spaces. Much of its business is with large corporations, but that sector represents less than half of the overall market. So, for us to really grow and be a player in North America, we had to play in the small business market, Parker concludes. Lenovo started its aggressive North American bid by telling customers to diversify their technologies beyond leaders Dell and HP. It would make sense to have a third horse to ride, and we should be that third horse, Parker says. The solution involves branding and product availability. The company is currently in year two of a $50 million branding campaign. Our brand for the people that know us is very strong, Parker says, but he admits that outside the IT space, not enough people know Lenovo. The company has signed on as a sponsor of the National Football League, a move Parker is counting on to make Lenovo a household name. Lenovo's brand awareness has tripled over the past year, Parker says, but that doesn't mean we have a ways to go. As far as availability, it's improving. Two holiday seasons ago, you could find Lenovo products in 400 storefronts across the United States and Canada. Now you can find our products 2 years later in 4,000 storefronts. Even as Lenovo pushes further into the U.S. market, there are more growth opportunities in emerging markets. While 80% of U.S. households have PCs, that percentage falls to 20% in emerging markets. For a company like Lenovo that is just truly focused on the PC space, that puts us at an advantage, Parker says. In its 2012 annual report, Lenovo stated that 18% of sales were in emerging markets, compared to 36% in mature markets and 46% in China. Lenovo announced in May it would be expanding its U.S. headquarters in Morrisville by adding 70,000 square feet. And now, Asian Trade Pact has the local biotech sector leaders worried. By Jason DeBrun from Research Triangle Park. A provision in the health care reform law approved by Congress allows United States delegates to negotiate more international protections for biotechnology companies. However, if negotiators continue to ignore an intellectual property discussion, as local biotechnology experts fear they will, it could mean less innovation and more job loss here in the Triangle. Delegates from the United States have been meeting with those from other countries to hash out specifics of what's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. The leaders of the biotech drug companies to the leaders of biotech drug companies, the concern is more about what is not being discussed. Although negotiators concluded their 14th round of discussions on September 14th, delegates have not discussed a data exclusivity point that would give biotech drug developers protections from generic drug manufacturers overseas. They seem to be focusing on other things and leaving intellectual property rights towards the end of the negotiation process, says Sam Taylor, CEO of North Carolina Bio, the North Carolina Biosciences Organization. Leaders of companies such as Biogen Iodec, which is based in Weston, Massachusetts, and employs 900 in Research Triangle Park, are following the discussions because decisions made could affect their product, says Mike McBrearty, a company spokesman. The discussions affect drug companies that develop what are called large molecule drugs or biologics, which are more difficult to protect through a patent. These are manufactured in a living system such as a microorganism or plant or animal cells, according to the biotechnology industry organization based in Washington, D.C. A small molecule drug is typically manufactured through a very specific chemical synthesis, the end result of which a developer can then patent. A biologic, by contrast, involves a much higher number of substances and is difficult to patent because of the variety of its makeup. Another developer could make something very similar that fights the same disease, but since it would not be exactly what is covered under a patent for the original discovery, the original company would not be able to protect its intellectual property. For this reason, biotechnology companies want what is called data exclusivity as protection, says Stephanie Fisher with BIO in Washington. It can cost hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars to develop a new drug, but because of the protections, like a patent, a developer has exclusive rights to that product for 20 years. In exchange for the patent, the company must make its findings public, filed with the U.S. Patent Office, and when the patent runs out, any other company may use that information. This protection allows the pharmaceutical company to sell the drug freer of competition for a while, recouping development costs before a generic manufacturer is allowed to make the same drug. When the patent expires, however, generic drug makers and patients can benefit from what research and not to have to reinvent the wheel. With biologics, however, a generic manufacturer could come from behind the initial developer and tweak the drug only slightly and then skirt any patent filed on the original biologic. The generic company would not have the upfront development costs, but would reap the benefit from that intellectual property. We need to give people enough time to recover the investment so you don't frustrate future innovation, Taylor says. He says the longer negotiations go on, the less likely it will be that biotechnology companies will receive the protections they need. It's what we haven't heard that greatly concerns us, he says. And now, Family Business by Mr. James Lee. Don't leave succession to chance. Develop a solid plan. I'm not worried about a succession plan. I mean, what else is Dad going to do with the company except hand it over to me? I'd run into my young friend Davey at the Carolina Moon Cafe and accepted his offer of coffee and a chat. His father and I had talked a few weeks earlier about a breakdown in communication between the two of them. It was a sad family situation, and it was also causing management problems for the business. As a matter of fact, I said, there are several things he could do with the company. For one, he could sell it to transnational importers. They've been trying to buy your dad out for the past couple of years, and their new offer is pretty tempting. Well, if the offer's so good, why didn't Dad take it? You know the answer to that one, David, I said. He's always hoped you'd come into the business and carry on the family name. In that case, he said, his dream is about to come true. All he has to do is sign some papers and hand over the office keys. We don't need to go through a bunch of succession planning malarking with the lawyers and accountants. Have you made a proposal to your father? He stared at me. Hey, nobody said anything about me buying the company. I'm his son. He'll just hand it over to me. Now, before you get too red in the face, I said, let me put in a word as an interested but objective observer. No business owner in his right mind just hands over his company, not even to his own kids. You're going to have to buy the business from your dad by one means or another. I'm sure he'll give you a good price, and you can probably finance it from company profits. Oh, no, he said. Those profits are staying with me. I've seen how my father and his buddies drive nice cars and take big fishing trips a couple of times a year. I'm ready for that lifestyle. He worked for more than 40 years building that business and doing without a lot of the comforts you take for granted. He's earned that lifestyle. You haven't. He pushed his coffee cup away and turned toward the plate glass window. I've been waiting for more than 7 years to take over the company and start living the good life, he muttered. I hadn't planned on coming up with the money to buy the thing. I thought he'd just give it to me. Yes, I agreed. Not having a plan for family business succession can bring on some real bummers. I think it's time you sat down with your dad and had a serious, open-minded, and open-hearted talk about the future. Then, when you're communicating again, maybe you can work together on a, I'm going to say that ugly old word, plan. Good luck to both of you, Davey. Next up, Technology Transforming Law Firms by Chris Bagley from Raleigh. A new range of technology is allowing attorneys and their corporate clients to work more closely with one another and, in many cases, bringing subtle changes to law firms' business models. The technologies range from tablet computers to software for sharing documents and managing litigation. In many cases, software is creating virtual offices that allow modest-sized firms to cut overhead costs and offer their clients lower fees. In other cases, expensive software can bring an additional layer of sophistication to law firms. Attorneys say many of the new technologies follow clients' newly sharpened focus on legal costs. Large clients such as pharmaceutical company GlaxoSmithKline have pushed their outside law firms away from hourly billing and into systems of flat fees and rewards for results. Many of those firms, including at least two in the Triangle, have begun to use what's known as project management, a system approach to planning, budgeting, and scheduling. Project management has been common in construction and many other industries for years, but has only recently caught on in the legal profession. At Poynter Spruill in Raleigh, Microsoft SharePoint software allows the firm and its clients' legal departments to share documents with one another, Chief Information Officer Ellen Kinsinger says. SharePoint also has project management tools, and it syncs up with clients' specialized project management software, she says. Litigation practices have been particularly fertile ground for new software, in part because the project management approach can help to meet court deadlines efficiently. Law firms and other outside contractors have also adopted specialized software to comb through the millions of electronic documents that plaintiffs and defendants request from one another. Such e-discovery software has been around for a decade, but has gotten a lot more advanced in the last couple of years, says Brian Vick, a litigator in the Raleigh office of Richmond-based Williams Mullen. Some use computer algorithms to determine which documents among millions his client has to turn over to an opposing party, Vick says. Earlier this year, a federal court gave litigants the green light to use such analytics software in a wider range of situations, Vick says. There's a lot of very neat software out there, he says. Firms are beginning to put more money into such technology after cutting back sharply during the recession. A survey by the International Legal Technology Association earlier this year found that just over half of all law firms are expanding their tech budgets, while 15% are cutting tech spending. Large and mid-sized firms typically spend $8,000 to $17,000 per attorney per year, according to the survey. Association Director Randy Mays says some firms have begun to post online databases with detailed information about legal work that they've done. Potential clients can search such a database to evaluate a firm's expertise with a particular legal issue. One of the most common new technologies, and certainly the most visible, is attorneys' widespread adoption of tablet computers such as Apple Incorporated's iPad, which allows them to serve clients more or less around the clock. An attorney carrying a tablet while taking a child to daycare, for example, can immediately call up a document to answer a client's question. About 13% of large and mid-sized law firms buy tablets for at least some of their attorneys, and most firms provide IT support for attorneys' own laptops, according to the ILTA survey. This week's editor's notebook from Sugata Mukherjee is titled A Doctor's Passion, A Region's Reputation. Don't tell the 65-year-old Dr. David Clemens to slow down. If anything, the UNC scientist and researcher is working harder than ever these days. Not because he really has to or because he doesn't have a hobby. He wants to pursue his golden years, but because he loves his work. And frankly, there are scores of folks like Clemens spread across our community, thanks to our universities and research units of the big companies such as Bayer Crop Science, IBM, RTI, and many others. The Triangle is a research haven with a disproportionate share of PhDs who fuel our impressive reputation every day. Speaking with a group of foreign entrepreneurs in Chapel Hill recently, I was struck by how these business people from Peru, Chile, Spain, and South Korea view our area as a hotbed of new ideas. And that got me thinking about Clemens. Someone at church asked me the other day where my wife was. I told them in Turks and Caicos, Clemens said laughingly, and they said, "Why aren't you there?" Clemens is not there because he believes he is onto something that, if successful, could change the lives of diabetic patients all over the world. In 2006, he started a company called Vascular Pharmaceuticals to work on monoclonal antibodies, a compound that works on patients with high blood glucose. In other words, the compound attacks a very specific part of the body, and initial studies showed promise. That was enough for a few venture capital firms, and Johnson & Johnson to collectively pour $16 million into Vascular this month and greenlight the company to continue its research. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the U.S. spent $120 billion in 2007 to take care of diabetic patients, with more than 26 million people affected by the disease. But what makes Clemens special? He refuses to relent, even as he and his team members working on the toxicity studies of the glucose compound, he is gearing up to attack yet another disease, cancer. Clemens recently filed paperwork to start new Paradigm Therapeutics and expects to receive initial grants from the National Institutes of Health. This research will focus on the antibodies that work in the field of cancer and osteoporosis, Clemens says. To the foreign delegates I recently visited with, it's people like Clemens who are giving this area a good name. It's not our football teams, our basketball prowess, or even our shiny new office towers. It is the vast resource of intellect we have among us that could one day make this area a world-class region on the levels of the likes of New York, Paris, and Hong Kong. We want to hear more about these brilliant minds, and we must make the process as easy as possible for them to do what they do best for the betterment of humankind. Don't slow down now, Dr. Clemens. Ramses is dead. Long live Ramses. UNC Chapel Hill has a new ram as its mascot due to the untimely death of 2-year-old Bam Bam, who died of a ruptured kidney in March, only a month after becoming Ramses the 19th. Now welcome Ramses the 20th. A babe at the age of just 7 months, he made his debut at UNC's football home opener against Elon and has performed well. The new ram's real name, by the way, is Rocky, and that's not as in Rocky Top for curious Tennessee fans. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at www.triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.